and welcome to the Trash Tapes Podcast as part of the Enigmatic Productions Network. If you love bad cinema and incredible deep dives into cult film, then you have come to the right place. So if you like what you hear and want to support us, you can do so by donating some funds to our Buy Me a Coffee website, along with the Acast supporter feature. All of these can be found in the description below. And now, on with the show.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Now, watch out for visions of glamour and murder. Johann Chappal presents some high-class sleaze on the not-so-trash reviews.
Hello, movie buffs and cinephiles, and welcome to another episode of the Not So Trash Reviews. My name is Johann Chappal, your psychic host with high-class fashion and a taste for cinematic blood. On this episode, I'm joined by film historian and co-host of the CineLit podcast, Daryl Buxton, as we review the 1978 disco giallo, The Eyes of Laura Mars. It was a wonderful examination into the world of 70s chic, as well as a little exploration to the works of Faye Dunaway, who will be making another appearance soon on the other Trashier podcast. What made this review and, well, this whole film so interesting is how, despite it being what's considered to be a sleazy thriller with sex, blood, and clear exploitation of some very taboo subjects, it opened a world of discussion about the art world. We'll be exploring the idea of cultural status theory using this film as our subject. But what does that even mean? Well, it's time to grab our finest wine and get comfy. We're going to define the difference between highbrow and lowbrow. The debate between what is high art versus low art is one that has been a continuous cycle through the philosophical world. It is usually hard to define, as it is always open to reinterpretation, as well as the growth of societal norms, culture, and the overall populace. It is almost the great divide. But what we're going to try to do is find some kind of definition. Artist Max Felser states that the concept of high and low culture can be traced back all the way to the ancient civilizations, but it's mostly linked back to those who focus on the intellectual and the mastery of the craft, compared to those who went with the popular and the use of the simplistic utility, as it was called. It was only until writers and philosophers started to examine this that a line was almost drawn. In the art world, high art can be seen as those who have been inspired by the classics and traditional fine art techniques. We're looking at works along the lines of Leonardo da Vinci, for example. While low art uses themes that the regular man might recognize. So in this case, we're looking at pop art. So we're looking at subjects like heroes, celebrities, and soup cans compared to Greek gods. Both are seen today as pure art, but in its own paradoxical way, provide their own classification of what pure art can be. Both of them can be seen at a high level, but some of them can also be seen as a low level. Who presents what is highbrow and lowbrow art anyway? Well, What we might consider as high culture has always been connected to the bourgeoisie, also known as the upper middle class, where experiences are seen as intellectually stimulating, unique, and linked to the elite status, while low culture is seen as common and simplistic, with no finesse, sophistication, and only fit for purpose. So the original argument of things such as opera versus pop music, theatre versus comic books, poetry versus pornography, art house versus blockbuster. Andrew Murphy and John Potts, in their book Culture and Technology, examines this theory, but now using the changes in the modern world, as there's now a whole new way of establishing the zeitgeist, especially with new tech. Let's look at a recent example. Kate Bush can be considered a bit of a highbrow musical artist that only a particular niche group of fans may have known or connected with in its original state, but has now gotten popular again thanks to the use of her music in what could be considered a popular lowbrow show, Stranger Things. It has introduced her work to a whole new generation of people who may not have had the opportunity to do so otherwise. There was no attempt at gatekeeping here, and so it organically grew. It is the viral sensation that allows us, the low class, to have a say and no longer have the elite choose. Now in cinema, this is a little different. We obviously have the idea of the dumb blockbuster and the high, classy arthouse film, but cinema explores this a little differently by trying to break the whole cultural status into question by how it blends both of these together. Now, examples of this could be Michael Haneke's Funny Games and the use of violence, graphic sex in the movie Short Bus, the exploration of the taboo in the works of Gaspar Noé, and even the use of high-class stars in high-camp schlocky genres, such as Bette Davis and Joan Crawford in the horror thriller Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. So, now we have this movie to examine it under the arty lens. I want to ask you, the listeners, what do you define as classy and as smutty? What is the difference between being sophisticated and being uncultured? Is this movie an exploration of intelligent art, or is it just a sleazy wolf in sheep's clothing? Now that is up to you. Let us see the vision through the eyes of Laura Mars.
In a world of breathtaking models and the beautiful people, Academy Award winner Faye Dunaway is photographer Laura Mars. Her work, the subject of controversy. Tommy Lee Jones is Detective John Neville, intrigued by her photographs for his own reasons. Somewhere between the sensations of high fashion and the precise form of her art lies another dimension, unexplored. Unexpected. Unwillingly, Laura Mars becomes a witness to a series of murders, watching through the eyes of a killer. Her world, sensual, dazzling, provocative. His world, demanding, dangerous, violent. Pursued by visions, she is linked to a killer. At any place, at any time, a witness. At any moment, a victim of her own eyes. Eyes of Laura Mars.
And I'm joined here by Daryl. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks, Johan. Yeah, really looking forward to this. Great to be back on the show.
Yeah, it's been nice. It's good to have you on the show for two reasons. One, the last one we did was for the other podcast where we talked about Pink Flamingos, which honestly, it was one of my favorite episodes to record because I was just I'm blown away by your by literally how much knowledge is stored in your head. And so I it's the only episode where really I didn't have to do that much research. I could just let you just spew it out, which was wonderful.
Yeah. Well, from my point of view, it's nice to have an outlet where I can pour all this stuff out and get it out of my head.
Indeed. And it was, like I said, it was a lot of fun. I wanted to get you back on the show. When I wanted to get you back on the show, I was thinking of films that would work well with both the fact that you're a film historian, but also a movie that kind of, well, blurs the lines in this case from being a trashy movie to something that's high art. And so in this case, I gave you Eyes of Laura Mars to watch, which is a movie I just discovered fairly recently. I found this because there was a deal on Powerhouse Films. They do fantastic Blu-rays, and they did something in their indicator field where it just got the Blu-ray out for only £9. So I was like, oh, okay, I'm curious about this one, looking at the description, and I was kind of blown away by it because I was not expecting this kind of movie out of what the advertisements gave it of as being this sort of this kind of sleazy movie, when really it's a lot more than that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let's put this in a bit of context to start with. There was some If you go back to the rise of the sort of backwards exploitation slasher movie, which we both love, you know, the days of Friday the 13th and Maniac and My Bloody Valentine, all those great movies, there was a weird thing going on in American film at that time, whereby and I suppose global film, where in that same period, late 70s, early 80s, you'd got your sort of trashy slashers, which were aimed at a drive-in audience or a younger movie audience. Mm. But what do mum and dad do? What do your granny do? And Murder on the Orient Express had been a big hit in 1974 for Sidney Lumet. A spate of Agatha Christie adaptations started coming along in the late 70s, paralleling the slasher movie. And they were like slasher movies for your granny sort of thing. You know, The Mirror Cracked and Death on the Nile. These were the body count movies that your sort of auntie and uncle would go to see. You know, you'd be their age sort of 16, 17, as I was, watching Friday the 13th, you know, and your sort of elder relatives or people you knew that were older would be going to see Agatha Christie. Now, what was also happening in parallel with all this is that there was this certain strand of American cinema that sort of looked at the slasher movie and thought, well, you know, these guys have got something. You know, why don't we elevate this, put major stars in it, and do this strand of films that we'll sort of sell as real proper films that might win awards and things, you know, and have big stars in them. So you get stuff like, I suppose, Dressed to Kill is an interesting one, Brian De Palma, because that's a film. De Palma was known to horror fans because of things like Carrie and The Fury and Obsession and so on. So we knew and trusted De Palma, and it's, oh, Brian De Palma's made a new horror film. But Dressed to Kill fits right into this other sort of band of movies. It's got Angie Dickinson and Michael Caine in it. You know, it's got stars that your mum and dad have heard of.
Yeah.
They've not heard of anyone in the cast of The Burning, you know. So, Dressed to Kill's a good example. But even better examples, even sort of further afield, things that might not necessarily appeal to horror fans. You've got stuff like The Fan with Lauren Bacall. You've got John Huston, the director of some of the greatest Hollywood classics of all time, making a thing called Phobia with Paul Michael Glaser.
Yeah.
You've got Still of the Night with Meryl Streep and Roy Scheider. And you've got... before all of these, perhaps the pioneer, perhaps the groundbreaker in all this, we've got Eyes of Laura Mars. We've got Faye Dunaway, who's just coming off the back of winning Best Actress at the Oscars for Network, you know, and she signs up to this thing, which to all intents and purposes is a a high-class slasher movie.
It is.
And so, yeah, it's part of this weird little trend that was going on of these big-budget, major studio, big promotion movies that they sort of tried to pretend weren't horror films. But the great thing is, I'm saying that these were films that your mum and dad might go and see. The great thing is, all of the slasher movie fans were going to see them anyway.
So it kind of felt as if this is sort of like the middle ground, as it were, saying, right, let's elevate what was sort of like these slasher movies. And in this case, I'd argue that this is sort of like Hollywood's interpretation of the Giallo movie, and say, all right, well, if we're going to do this, let's get a big star in. Let's really focus on making it look like an actual Hollywood movie and not something that seems a little bit too seedy for the mainstream audience.
But if you think about the Giallo, there was this major strand of Giallo. In fact, Giallo sort of emerged from that. The key films in the late 60s, films like the Umberto Lenzi ones with Carol Baker in the lead, they did a string of films together, or Lucio Fulci's Perversion Story, weren't really horror movies. They were more sort of glossy thrillers, and they were often set in this rarefied world that me and you wouldn't be allowed into, in sort of gated communities or people living in these big mansions and stuff. And some of the better Gialli were films like Black Belly of the Tarantula and things like Death Walks on High Heels, and they were set in these sort of glossy worlds of sort of high fashion and high finance and weird families who were sort of conspiring against each other, and it's that, I think, that passes on to this particular strand of American cinema. I think it's the high class Giallo that was sort of taken on board by Hollywood at its highest echelons, and so you were getting people like Faye Dunaway, and as I say, Angie Dickinson, Meryl Streep, people like that were appearing in these things. People that everybody had heard of.
It's really wonderful because by this point, it's almost feels like this is elevated trash, if I would say it that way. It's elevated trash in a weird way because it's point saying, look, if this was not done by big stars, this would have been directly into the bargain bin. No one would have seen it. People would have seen it as a cult hit. Yeah. But now that you've got Faye Dunaway and a very, very baby-faced Tommy Lee Jones, by the way, which I was surprised when I saw this going, ooh, you are very young.
Yeah. Do you know what? Tommy Lee has got, if you think back to the way that Henry Winkler and John Travolta looked at the time when they weren't slicking their hair back to look like they were from the 1950s, but the sort of modern late 70s Henry Winkler and John Travolta, Tommy Lee's got that sort of thing going on here.
It's got this elevate again, this kind of classy look to the whole thing.
And this is why we're not doing this on the trash tape. There is that distinction here. I think there is that extra level to Eyes of Laura Mars. It could easily be a sort of camp classic. It could easily fall into the level of trash. And sometimes when I watch it, I sort of watch it through what would John Waters make of this sort of eye.
Yeah.
But you can also watch it and just take it at absolute face value and think, the studio clearly thought this was a contender. They were making a prestige movie here.
Yeah, because on the Blu-ray I got, there was a behind-the-scenes documentary made at the time called Visions. And the way they were selling it, having the big actors and the directors and the models talking about this as this is, which basically is the thesis of the movie, is the idea of high art versus trash.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole idea and most of the time, I say what we're doing is basically showing it as the argument of what is art.
These photographs are the unspoken stars of the film. The photographs deliver their message with provocative, even shocking images, all part of a new wave of sensual, sensational art.
Either we get to the age-old question of is it art and is it not, I don't know, but I saw some photographs that moved me. Well, I think stirred my spirit, my mind to an appreciation or an understanding of what the photograph was about that I would not have normally had, and maybe that's somehow related to what art is.
I think of what we do sometimes as being chic news, presented beautifully, and which to me says that it's positive.
Moving from the sensations of high fashion to the precise form of her art, the film reveals another dimension unexplored, unexpected.
And so it feels like, again, it's automatically putting it from a different perspective, because you can watch it as a trashy slasher movie or watch it as an examination of what is art, which not what I was expecting when watching this. Again, all the advertisements did a very weird thing here where they were promoting it as a sleazy movie. But then once you look into it more, it's clearly not. In fact, I'd argue that all the murders in this film are the least interesting part, other than some of the cool visual of it. It's not the murders. It's the intrigue. It's the drama. It's the character development in between.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a film that's commenting on itself, isn't it? You know, you're absolutely right, Johan. And it's so aware. The production is so aware of itself. And and yet manages not to go up its own arse, you know. I mean, the idea that they bring Helmut Newton in as the photographer to actually take all of the pictures that we're shown on screen as being the work of Laura Mars, i.e. Faye Dunaway, you know.
Yeah.
And Helmut Newton, who's the great sort of glossy sort of fashion photographer of that era, who was actually doing this sort of controversial stuff himself. So, and you've got things like the Roxy Music album covers as well, which are sort of Newton imitations, which are coming out from sort of 1972, 73 onwards. So they actually precede all this. And so Newton's been doing this stuff for a few years as well. And now the Laura Mars production is canny enough to say, let's get this guy on board and let's actually have him take our photos that we can then pass off as the work of Faye Dunaway. But those photos absolutely comment on what the debate about this film is, you know.
One thing I did not realize is that this is a John Carpenter film.
Yes, it is. Yeah, Carpenter was one of those young guys who was struggling to make his way into Hollywood and make his way into the movie business from the early 70s. You know, he'd been to film school, he'd made some successful short films and things. He teamed up with some of the right people, and he teamed up with Jack H. Harris, who had been the producer of The Blob back in the 50s.
Yeah.
And Harris had sort of taken Carpenter under his wing a little bit. And they'd made he'd got Dark Star released, the Carpenter science fiction comedy. Carpenter had become a big hit with British critics when Assault on Precinct 13 came out. That was a critical smash in Britain. And certainly in Britain and Europe, it was like, oh, there's this hot new director from the States. Watch what he's going to do. 1978 is an interesting year for him because he'd written this script called Eyes.
Yes.
In the mid-70s, which is what develops into Eyes of Laura Mars. Mm. And he pitched that around Hollywood, and Jack H. Harris tried to help him sell it. And it fell into the hands of John Peters, who listeners may have seen the recent Oscar-nominated film Licorice Pizza, where Bradley Cooper brilliantly plays the real-life John Peters, who was Barbara Streisand's boyfriend.
Yeah.
And he was one of those great, this could only happen in the mid-70s, he was one of those great celebrity hairdressers that you have.
Yes.
Back then, you know? And being a celebrity hairdresser, he wangled his way into Barbara Streisand's affections by teasing her lock, you know. And then, because this is the 70s and because it's Hollywood, he decided, I'm going to become a movie producer.
Magic.
And he had several stabs at trying to make Superman over the years, and that's a whole mad story.
If you've ever heard Kevin Smith talk about the story he has with John Peters, is astronomically hilarious.
He's like, I got some directives for you if you're going to move forward on the process, some things I want you to do and don't in the script. He's going, three things. Okay, I said, all right. So one, I don't want to see him in that suit. Two, I don't want to see him fly. And three, he's got to fight a giant spider in the third act. And I'm like, let's go back to one. When you say you don't want him in the suit, and he's like, don't want to see him in it. Don't want it. Looks too faggy, he goes. So he said, flying, I don't want to see him fly. I said, well, that's kind of the suit, and flying defines Superman. So don't want to see it, don't want to see him fly. No scenes where he's flying around carrying people, horse shit. All right, no flying. I said, but the giant spider intrigues me. Why that? And he's like, do you know anything about spiders? And I said, I mean, no. And he said, well, they're the fiercest killers in the insect kingdom. So I went back to Warner Brothers and sat down with them, and they said, we heard from him, he liked you, we're going to hire you, you're going to move forward. Did he bring up the spider? I said, he did, he brought up the spider, he tell you guys about the spider? Like, every day with the fucking spider.
He's quite a delusional producer.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he has
yeah.
certain things. And also, I'm not sure if it's nepotism, but it does make sense now why Barbara Streisand's in the soundtrack for this yeah. movie.
Well, she was actually mooted as the star initially.
Really?
Carpenter's script. Carpenter is nobody at this point. He's yes. just another struggling writer in Hollywood. And his script, his treatment comes to John Peters and Peters reads it and thinks, this would be fantastic for Barbara. And Barbara reads it and says, John, what are you talking about?
This is not for me.
No fucking way. You know, and this is so weird. I'm not doing this. But he then touts it around Hollywood. And being John Peters, very, very influential at the time, amazingly, you know, this is, you know, risen from being a sort of celebrity hairdresser to suddenly being one of the most powerful guys in Hollywood. And so if Barbara Streisand turns him down, what does he do? He thinks, well, what I'll do is pitch this instead. If Babs doesn't want to do it, I'm going to pitch this to the lady who won Best Actress at the Oscars last
and
year.
And gets
we keep
it.
Coming back to it. And she says, I'd love to do this. This looks really interesting. Well, you get that great pre-credit scene, which is wordless, where we sort of see a sort of negative of Laura's own eyes and
yeah.
Barbara Streisand doing that amazing power ballad on the titles. You
yeah.
then go into the sort of first vision, the first indication, this is a character who's having these weird visions. But then after the credits, we go into this thing where she's actually launching her new book, and she's at this sort of prestige sort of launch for the all of her new photographs coming
yeah.
out. And the debates among the audience are terrific.
Ta-da! You are perfect.
How is it in there?
Too early to tell. We're about to be clotheslined.
By whom?
Sheila Wiseman.
Miss Marlowe, Sheila Wiseman. We've met over President
Now, I remember you. How are you doing?
Fine. Sheila, we agreed pictures and interviews would be done inside the gallery.
Well, I just want to ask her if she knows how really offensive her work is to women.
Cute.
Does anyone have anything positive to ask?
Do you consider yourself a serious artist?
I'm very serious about my work.
Well, serious by what standard?
By my own standards.
Well, isn't that kind of an elitist position?
Honestly, I think I'd better take a fifth.
If you can do better than that, Miss Mars, really.
No, wait. Fellas, come on, give us a break here, huh?
The best exchange at that soiree is you sort of, I don't think you even see who says this, but you just sort of overhear this dialogue in the background, a conversation where someone says,
whatever happened to beautiful? Well, it certainly isn't here.
I love that. One of my favorite exchanges in here, which is basically the full-blown thesis almost of at least the first half of the film, at least, is when you got one of the models who literally is talking to camera and saying, like, we live in a violent world, everything's violent, so why not just show it up there, and why not have all this violence not only shown out there, but to help you advertise for perfume?
So what I think Laura is saying with the work is like, okay, America, okay, world, you are violent. You are pushing all this murder on us. So here it comes, right back at you. And we'll use murder to sell deodorant so that you'll just get bored with murder. Right?
That is a whole stance on it. If you are, the news is already showing you all this murder, which is a reflection on things like the Vietnam War and the news cycle at the time. So we're saying, well, if it's all out on the news, why can't we have it in our advertising then? It's already out there in the media.
Sure.
So why not just put it on the side of a bus? Which is fascinating when you actually see shots of basically like these two women scantily clad holding a cigarette on a motorcycle saying, IR perfume, pretty much.
This sort of thing goes back to the famous or infamous Beatles album cover in the 60s that was scheduled to be released in the States, where they're all sort of covered in meat and holding up dolls representing dead babies and things, you know. And this was sort of mid-60s when the Beatles are doing that. And, of course, they were sort of castigated for it. And you can't do this. And here's Laura Mars sort of pitching the same sort of idea of, yeah, let's put this meat at the heart of what we're doing.
Do you think that art can be trashy, or is there two different like broken down that way? Can art be trashy, or can trashy be art?
I love the whole great miasma of it. I love the whole mix. It's the answer to all of those questions is yes.
Yes, they can
both be
that.
I'm leaving it at that.
No, I love that. And I think the whole thing is they're both the same. They're just people's interpretations of art. So because, you know, there's always the argument with art where, you know, when someone goes to a modern art museum, someone goes to the Tate Modern and looks at, for example, there is just a brick in the middle of a room and someone calls it art. People will go like, I get it. It's art. It is art. Yeah, and you can argue that is still a piece of art, despite the fact you do not understand what it means.
Yeah. Even the murders in Eyes of Laura Mars are art.
Yes.
The killer is an artist, which again is a great Giallo conceit. You know, the killings in Giallo films are always staged in spectacular fashion, and people have even said, you know, a later Giallo film, Dario Argento's Tenebrae from the
I
Master
love Tenebrae.
The form, there's a great scene where someone is killed in their apartment and their arm is sliced off and blood sprays up against the wall.
It's beautiful.
Various critics have pointed out, you know, the spray of blood up against that white wall in the apartment is like a piece of modern art. And you get that sense in Eyes of Laura Mars, because the central image of the actual murders themselves is somebody stabbing an ice pick into somebody's left eye, and that happens over and over and over again, even to the point where the book cover, Mars book cover with her eyes on it, gets an ice pick in the left eye at one point. And the image, you could frame, you could literally frame that. Two eyes, one of them, the left one, with a weapon and the handle of a weapon sticking out of it, and especially when the book cover is or the picture of the book cover is stabbed, you've even got shattered glass around it all. You know, the image is sensational, and again, that's taken right out of what the Italians were doing.
I'm going to go to the ending without spoiling it, but there's a wonderful scene where the confrontation happens, and then the killer staring into their own reflection in the mirror stabs it again in the left eye situation.
The killer even stabs himself in the eye.
And it's
wonderful.
It's wonderful symmetry that leads up to the big confrontation near the end. Yeah. Which
and what does that tell you about the killer's psyche as well? You know, that they see themselves as a victim.
Yeah, and it's really bizarre because there's a wonderful conversation where they sort of like, in sort of a silly sort of Machiavellian supervillain way, literally spews the entire thing out. And it's wonderful and hammy and beautiful.
I'd suggest that's possibly David Zelig Goodman rather than Carpenter, because Carpenter would have seen Psycho and thought, I love this film, up until the bit where they sort of regurgitate the entire plot in the last 5 minutes, you know. So I imagine that Carpenter would have left that a little more sort of up in the air, and that Hollywood has come on and said, no, we need to explain the psychology of this.
Yeah,
know?
Almost in a way of saying, like, there's enough breadcrumbs here. It's like, we got breadcrumbs, but almost like a very Hollywood way of saying, like, audiences can be quite dumb. So let's do a moment there. Although it's funny
we need the whole loaf.
Again, to add the sort of trashy, almost comical point of it, the killer goes literally at one point, rams through a glass window, almost in a hilariously comical fashion that comes out of left field.
Always the visuals are centered around violence, and again, it keeps coming back to this theme of, can violent things and can things being broken and smashed, and can people being broken and smashed Can that be art? Can that be visually interesting? Can that be appealing? And the answer is yes, yes, yes. And the film keeps telling you that.
Yep.
You know, and those people that are sniping at the book launch at the start are wrong. You know, I think all you only hear negative comments about this in that opening scene.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time, we as the audience are encouraged to revel in this and say, yeah, this is great. We like what we're seeing here. We like this mixture of violence and the artistic. We love the fact that these models are sort of posing in these poses where they're sort of having fights or they've got blood all over themselves. I think the film comes down very much on the side of its own argument, which is, yeah, this stuff can work. You know, violence can be art. And then the whole other question, as you've mentioned, is should we use this to sell baked beans? Well, that's a whole other thing.
That's a whole other argument. Yeah. With the photo shoot on the New York street, which is this over elaborate car crash scene where people are getting beaten up, sawn all over, fire. It's genuinely beautiful to look at, even though the act itself is downright scary.
Yeah, and again, it's the film pitches itself between those two. You know, it's and it sort of forces you to say, look. This image has got terrifying things in it. It's got fire and it's got girls clawing at each other, pulling their hair out and catfighting on the streets. And there's a crowd sort of gathered around watching it as well, which is fascinating. You know, I love that aspect of it. But the images we're seeing are gorgeous.
They're really pretty.
The burning cars look fantastic. Manhattan in the background looks amazing. And even the photographer looks fabulous. You know, Laura herself is a fashion plate. You know, she's wearing the latest high fashions and looking fabulous. And yet the art that she produces, and again, even I call it art there, but there's even a bit of a dichotomy there because you know, she's producing art, but as you've already mentioned, it's commercial too. It's being used to sell stuff, and she's even selling her own photos. You know, never mind using it to sell products. The photo is the product.
Is she using exploitation to her advantage here to make high art, or is she saying it's high art, but actually everyone's starting to see it's more exploitation? It's an interesting argument.
Yeah, there's an absolutely fascinating bit in the script, and it's almost not sort of dug into. They almost sort of gloss over this a little bit. Mm. But there's actually a point where there's a very little minor suggestion that Tommy Lee Jones might regard Laura as he's the investigating cop, of course, and he might regard Laura as an actual suspect.
Yes.
He says, look, you know, your photos are actually mirroring the killings. Exactly. And they are because the plot of the film, the gist of the film, is that Laura's not only a photographer, but she's having these visions. She has visions of the murders before they happen, but then goes out and photographs those visions and restages them as tableau. So the obvious thing that the police think is, are you actually doing this?
These are classified police photographs of unsolved murders.
Right.
They've never been published anywhere at all. Now, what I would like you to do is compare your photograph to ours. So my question is very simple.
Why are my photographs so much like yours?
That's right.
When were these photographs taken?
About 2 years ago. This one about 14 months.
You think I was in those actual situations, committed the murders, and then recreated them in photographs? I don't buy it.
Let's look at Laura Mars and let's look at Detective Neville, because their interactions are fascinating, because watching it the first time round, the dynamic is one way. Watching it the second time round, not to throw any spoilers in there, but the dynamic of the whole movie suddenly changes to for me.
Oh yeah, it's one of those films where when you watch it the second time and you know how it all comes out, it's a completely different film.
It is, because I'm a little bit in a quandary here, because I want people to watch this movie. I'm not sure whether to spoil it, because I don't want to. I think
we should avoid spoilers if we can, but by doing that, we will tell any listeners that we're actually in not spoiling the film, we're taking away a whole level of really fascinating conversation. I think there's so much we could say about this film that not being able to give spoilers, I think just takes away an awful lot here. But one thing to say about the relationship between the detective and Laura is that I gather that got Irving Kirshner the job of directing The Empire Strikes Back.
You think so?
George Lucas saw Eyes of Laura Mars and he loved the film and he loved what Kirshner did with it. And I gather that he particularly loved the romance.
Mm.
And he contacted Kirshner and said, you're the guy to do what I want to do with The Empire Strikes Back.
Fascinating.
So you've got the George Lucas seal of approval on this relationship and on these characters. So anything we say about them in the next few minutes, George Lucas agrees with. So
yeah.
Look through that. Now, if you think of that camera as the eyes of the killer, what you're seeing through that lens is what the killer sees. It's on the monitor there. When it happens to me, I can't see what's in front of me. What I see is that. Do you understand?
Yeah. Let me try that. It's like a lot of fun.
What?
Is that how I look? I look like that?
Well, I think that's how you look.
Well, I look like a damn cop is what I look like.
You know, I find all of this very interesting. And I'm going to double the security around you. I'd advise you to stay indoors as much as possible.
Talking about the romance there, it's interesting how it develops, because it's the idea of having Tommy Lee Jones, who is the detective at the time, already starting off with a bad note and slowly whether the idea of legitimately falling for Laura Mars, or the idea that it's a sort of like this power dynamic slowly starts to shift.
That's being done in a sort of coy I like the look of Laura, let's pretend I don't know who she is and use that as the first step to getting to know her, in a sort of romantic sense. And here it's down to business. He's sort of doing the same thing, but he's doing it as part of his day job, and suddenly it's got this more sort of sinister turn to it,
As for someone who's doing their day job, he's kind of infatuated a little bit with her by saying, like, there's a scene, for example, where he says, oh, by the way, any day or night, here's my card. There's a line where it's like, do I need to hire a bodyguard? And he just goes, you already have one. It's almost like instigating already. Do not worry. I'm here for you. I am the detective on the case. Come to me. And this is what happens, because then he becomes sort of the instigating incident of all the possible suspects in this scene. Because obviously this, the thing is, it's not necessarily all the murders that are happening aren't random. They're all connected to her own inner circle. And so she's feeling traumatized by this, because obviously it's like, it's just a business acquaintance. Then it's a close friend. Then it's the models. And so by that point you're going, oh no, this is literally people who, so it has to be someone who knows me.
Yeah. The inference there, of course, is that whoever the killer is also creeping steadily closer towards Laura herself.
There is a fantastic scene, which I love, which this is a scene where, for me, this is fully out of a over-the-top giallo movie, is when she is in her studio alone. And then suddenly she gets the vision. Which I love how the vision's done, very simply. It's just a close-up of her eyes, close-up, and then this blurred image of the shot.
Yeah, the old Vaseline on the lens, lots of gels and stuff, yeah. But it's great. It works. Why not use it?
And then from that bit, seeing like, oh, no, this vision can see me. And then she runs out of the place, in which, again, another slight of whether high class or high art or trash. Her studio's in an abandoned warehouse, basically, this abandoned seaside warehouse, which is derelict. And so you see the shot where she leaves the studio and, terrified, runs down this large, huge, empty, derelict warehouse, screaming bloody murder, asking for anyone to help go. And it's a genuinely beautiful, terrifying shot of her running manic. It's a shot that you could have taken out of any Italian giallo movie for
concept. You can imagine Rosalba Neri or Edwige Finesse or somebody like that in Faye's position, you know, and it is a very, very Italianate shot. Yeah.
But that's the thing. It's like the thing that makes it more interesting. It's done by Faye Dunaway, who is one of the biggest stars at the time, pulling off this shot.
As we say, you know, I think at the time of the shoot, she was the reigning best actress from the previous year's Academy Awards, you know.
Her performance is fascinating because it's a bit of combination. It's slightly in the sense that it does elevate at points, which I find absolute. For me, as a band movie fan, I kind of love when something just goes a little over the top.
Yeah.
Another person we have to forget, a very young babyface, Raul Julia's in this.
Oh, yes, yeah. Although Raul apparently had some problems with the production and took his name off it. If you look in the credits, he's credited as RJ.
I didn't realise that. Obviously, because I know who Raul Julia is. Like I say, who it is.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know what happened there, actually. That's an intriguing situation.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the full details, but I know that he was very sort of disenchanted with the film and the whole production, and decided, you know, he's at this point, Raoul is known as being a big theatre star since going back to the mid 60s, you know, and he's started getting into movies more recently, and here's a big prestige one for him, working alongside Faye Dunaway, and he, rather than just accept that and go with the flow, he says, no, there's something I don't like here. I'm taking my name off the credits.
There's something interesting with that because Raul Julia plays Laura's ex-husband. And again, another red herring MacGuffin suspect character that kind of appears. And it's interesting because his character is fascinating. He is he's almost like the full let loose sort of broken down version of what Laura would be. Laura focuses entirely on her work, and she revels in that, and she enjoys that. While Raul Julia, who's an author, just can't do that. So he always goes to the bottle. He is kind of a sex pest. He's unhinged. And
I also think that in his look and in his demeanor and in his sort of gruffness and in the sort of the deep voice that he uses, he's sort of a mirror of the Tommy Lee Jones character in a way as well. So there's bits of the detective and bits of Laura in this figure.
Yeah, it's kind of like the middle ground almost.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't look at me like that. I did not kill Elaine.
What reason would I have to kill her? She was the best meal ticket I ever had.
Second best. I was the best. Why, Elaine? Do you have to destroy everything you touch?
This whole thing is pointing towards me, and I did not do it. Everything I have is in Elaine's apartment. I have no money, no clothes. The police are after me, and now you provoke me. You deliberately provoke me. You may have all these other people fooled, but I know what a killer you can be at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, no. A killer at 3 o'clock
in the... Where were you? Where? When I needed something, when I needed some comfort, where were you? In your dark room.
Where else could I find any peace? You were in that bedroom.
You tore me apart. You made it impossible for me to write.
It's not true! Michael, you've been drunk for the last 6 years.
Oh, but you, instant star of the world of chic.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And this is what happens, because then he becomes sort of the instigating incident of all the possible suspects in this scene with involving ex-husband, Donald, who is, or Donald's sort of like his, sort of like her producer kind of vibe, who is, again, not entirely being honest, or at least being a bit more candid of the idea that, look, your visions are now getting the way of work. You need
to... Yeah, yeah.
Almost...
played by the great René Auberjonois, who is just fabulous in this. I think he's the best thing in the film. I've loved him for years. Going back to when he was in Robert Altman films in the early 70s, and he played the governor in the TV sitcom Benson as well, and I think he's absolutely terrific here. He really fits into the sort of camp sensibility of this film, I think. And he sort of leans it towards he's great because he's a very sophisticated character. And so even though he's someone who could fit into this film if it were a trash movie, René almost sort of drags this back into the world of sophistication and the world of high art. You know, he's a really, really great character. He wouldn't be seen dead in a John Waters film, you know, this guy. But we as the audience would sort of like to see him in one. But he's very definitely part of the sophisticated set, and he ain't budging from there. And his relationship with Laura is really interesting. And there's this three-way thing going on, because, of course, you've got Brad Dourif as Tommy, their driver, who seems to have a sort of dodgy... maybe druggy sort of past, or maybe sort of petty criminal sort of past, but he's dragged himself up by the bootstraps, and he's now got his chauffeur's cap on. He's driving these big stars around. René and Brad don't get on. You know, the characters Tommy and Donald don't get on, and they hate each other. And Laura's in the middle of this. She loves them both. She's friendly with both. And but there is this thing sort of stretching there. There is this sort of pull that this triangle isn't stable.
And this triangle not being stable adds more to it, because there's a whole section, basically, when they go to the police station the first time, which is sort of like basically after the second murder, almost as a weird way of almost saying, like, I'm putting this under the bus, almost kind of thing, like trying to keep it quiet. Tommy says, look, I need to confess something, which basically the idea, let me confess something. I did time. I did go to prison for burglary and assault with a deadly weapon and so on and so forth. Almost to confess, say, look, I'm being honest with you here because I do have a shady past, but I did not have anything to do with the previous murders.
Miss Mars, I don't know. The cops told me.
Let's talk about this some other time. Miss Mars has things on her
mind. And Mr. Phelps here has a few things that he'd like to tell you about me, but I'd rather tell you to myself.
What things, John?
Laura, I don't think this is an appropriate time.
Because I'm trying very hard to keep my cards on the table and my... self on the street.
Bad timing.
I did a bit. And I've been in prison.
What did you do, Tommy?
I was in for armed robbery and assault with a deadly weapon, and I've also had some prior arrests.
Jesus, spare us the soap opera.
You knew that, Mr. Phelps, when you hired me for Miss Mars.
What kind of deadly... You did? You knew that?
Why'd you find that so amazing? Laurie, you can't just talk about rehabilitation. I happen to believe in giving people a chance.
You believe in spit is what you believe in, and I'm not putting up with nobody.
I am not putting up with crap.
Just 5 minutes ago, you sat in this car and tried to railroad me.
Laura, are you going to let this
man sit here? Wait a minute. I don't want to hear any more.
Laura, I'm sorry.
Laura, I'm sorry.
No! That's it. Both of you, leave me alone.
And by that point, the history and the relationship gets really tattered to the point where when it is Donald's sort of birthday party celebration, well, Laura kind of wants Tommy to be there. Donald doesn't, because already suspects, like, no, you are trash compared to me. I am the sophisticated one. You are the gutter rat, pretty much.
He even leaves him very symbolically standing outside the door. You know, he's actually right outside the door of the apartment. Mm. And then he throws away this line saying, oh, we'll send you out a piece of cake, you know. And it's like totally dismissive.
Yeah, which adds more to...
You are nothing.
Which adds more to the whole dynamic of the high society versus low society. Highbrow versus lowbrow. Yeah. Is this art or is this trash?
Symbolized with the door in between it and with a literal let them eat cake thing going on as well, you know.
Tommy, would you come back in an hour for me?
Yeah. It's just hard, you know, to figure out what you're going to do with yourself in just an hour.
Could you work it out?
Yeah. Tommy, we'll save you a piece of cake. You're a piece of cake.
What's going on with the scene where Donald's actually dressed as Faye Dunaway? He's dressed as Laura.
I love that scene.
He's got secrets in the closet there, you know, and his party's amazing as well, because there's a pianist in it. Oh yeah, that's you know, all the guests appear to be male, you know, There's a whole lot about Donald that we never quite find out. You know?
There's enough scenes there to suspect that basically his homosexuality is okay and open to everybody, which I find quite fascinating.
Yeah, but it's sort of closeted to us, though, which is interesting.
It's only out until the end part where he says this is a thing. Yeah, but yeah. I love because everyone sort of mocks at the beginning when they first have I think he has a discussion with the copper. Sort of like these camp impressions and say, oh, I could do a very good Lloyd Bridges.
Which he does brilliantly just by screwing up his face.
It's brilliant.
I'm on his side all the way through, you know.
Yeah.
However bitchy he might get, whoever's clothes he might want to wear, whatever he might want to do at his party, I'm right there with the guy.
With that scene would make me laugh, is the idea of he's sick and tired of being called names, basically like closet case kind of vibe and whatever. But when he's in the dress and gets called, I just love the thing. It's the only part that really makes me laugh. It's like, what did you call me? You call me. It starts literally slapping the copper with his purse. It's just like, this is literally a farce now. This moment here is a comedy farce.
Yeah. Well, that's the moment where, as I say, you know, he may well be sort of known within his circles and within the community at large as being out. But it's interesting that the film does sort of closet him from us, the audience. You know, there is that barrier between us and him. And I think that's the point where he comes out to us.
Yeah, it's like, it's official. But look, if you haven't suspected by the party by this point, this is the final nail on it.
It seems like that, character relationships like that, that really, really strengthen this film, because aren't the red herrings in this film fantastic? You know, there's five or six characters that even considering that this is a very close-knit community and that Laura's only experiencing visions about people that she knows, and the killer is targeting people that she knows. So there can't be many suspects, but we actually end up with about half a dozen very, very convincing red herrings here. And I think that's the result of this, precisely of this sort of interplaying and the character relationships and the actors' performances. And I think that's never better than in this relationship between the René and the Brad Dourif characters.
It's perfect. And this is the thing, like, again, the writing here is so good. It's so well written, but also still has elements of a campy, trashy movie into
it. David Zelak Goodman, who is a sort of known quantity in Hollywood, and especially known as being what nowadays we call a script doctor.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if that term was being used back then, but he's someone that Hollywood recognised as, right, we've got this terrible script, but it's got a few great ideas in it. Let's send it to David Zelak Goodman and see what he can do with it. And his expertise was in taking a script, looking through it and saying, this is fantastic, but on page 13, that character is talking to someone in a way as though he knows them, and it's already been shown that he doesn't know them. Or he'd find little mistakes in there. He'd find little things that didn't quite fit, and he'd correct them. And I guess that he was brought on to do that with Eyes of Laura Mars.
Definitely.
And I don't quite know how much of John Carpenter remains in this and how much of it is Goodman. There are things that I can imagine Carpenter having written. I'm sure the whole vision thing and the whole sort
100%.
Of the whole body count thing is his. But and interestingly, you might think that the high fashion stuff may have been layered on by Hollywood afterwards. But in 1978 as well as making Halloween, and as well as seeing this come into production, Carpenter made a thing for TV called Someone's Watching Me, with Lauren Hutton, and she's playing a very high class, very high fashion character. And again, it's Lady in Peril stuff. She's living in this high rise apartment, a place you'd want to live, you know, just the ultimate apartment, and yet is being stalked by a killer in the building. You
know? 1 week from tonight, she's young, beautiful, successful, and has everything to live for, but someone wants her dead.
Hello?
Lauren Hutton, David Burney, and Adrian Barbeau star in a chilling tale of suspense and terror. A twisted maniac is at large. Can he be stopped before it's too late? Someone's Watching Me next Wednesday on NBC.
You might look at Eyes of Laura Mars and say, well, maybe Carpenter would have been a bit more blue collar and a bit more down to earth and wouldn't have gone into this world of high fashion. I think Someone's Watching Me shows that he was right there. And so I think, knowing what I know about David Zelak Goodman being someone who would come on board and doctor script, I would speculate that what we're seeing is a lot of John Carpenter, a lot more than you might think.
It's almost fascinating to think, like, there is an alternative universe somewhere where he actually makes Eyes the way he intended to, rather than Assault on Precinct 13.
I think that would have come out very much like the TV movie Someone's Watching Me. So if you want to see what John Carpenter's Eyes might have looked like, check out the film with Lauren Hutton, which he shot just before Halloween. It's weird. People tend to think of Carpenter as being, oh, yeah, he's this blue-collar guy. He went to film school. He dragged himself up by the bootstraps. He made Dark Star. He made Assault on Precinct 13. He made Halloween. And then he went to Hollywood. No. The truth is that there's all this stuff in between. Think about it. In between Halloween and The Fog, the guy made Elvis the movie, for Christ's sake.
Yes, he did, didn't he?
Tonight, a special presentation of the ABC Sunday Night Movie. To millions, he was the king. Elvis Aaron Presley.
Hey, kid, this is Sam Phillips. Listen, you want to come make some blues?
The greatest entertainer of the 20th century. Tonight, meet the man who became the legend.
I think you ought to seriously reconsider going back to driving a truck again.
The man whose music electrified two generations of America.
Here now, Elvis Presley.
Tonight, the myth becomes the man. The legend comes to life. The king lives again. Elvis.
Carpenter had this whole parallel career going on that people often ignore. I mean, Halloween is the great sort of blue collar slasher movie, you know, but he made Someone's Watching Me, which is this really great sort of high concept, high fashion thing with Lauren Hutton in it, before he made Halloween. And they look as though they'd have been made after. And Carpenter himself has said, oh, yeah, I learned so much on the set of Someone's Watching Me that I then bought to Halloween, you know. So if you watch, I think a great triple bill for Carpenter fans that would be a real eye-opener, no pun intended, is to watch Eyes of Laura Mars, then watch Someone's Watching Me, and then watch Halloween. I think you'd see Halloween in a completely different light.
You'd see this sort of literal, like, growth of a filmmaker upwards.
Yeah. But interestingly, sort of coming down in terms of clash, you know, in a sense.
Yeah, because what's happening afterwards is, like, John Carpenter's career is genuinely one of the most fascinating things, because all the movies that we love were, all the movies that we love now in retrospect are the ones which financially flopped because they were cultish. They were designed to be, they were almost designed to be a little bit, they were blue collared. But the movies that he learned a lot on were the ones which seemed to be what Hollywood wanted him to try out and do. Yeah. I remember Elvis the movie. I completely forgot about that, but I remember it now and going like, yeah, this is, he's not, especially at that age, at the age in the 70s, he's young, he's fresh, he wants to just work. He wants to put his stuff out there and try things out. It's a learning experience for him. And I feel like maybe he did want to make Eyes the way he wanted to do it, but realizing, learning it the hard way, going, look, Hollywood might not want it like this.
Yeah. The thing with Carpenter being involved here is Hollywood would, John Peters would not have had a clue what a giallo was.
Yes.
But John Carpenter was going to watch them all. He'd be seeing this stuff, you know, three times a month. He'd be going to watch Italian movies.
Yeah.
He'd know exactly what a giallo was, and he brings that sensibility to this. But you can imagine a Peters or the studio looking at this and thinking, well, we don't know where this stuff's coming from, but it's got a gloss that we can identify with.
So I usually like ending this with an elevator pitch. So if we were going to pitch this to someone who has never seen the movie before in a couple of sentences, how would we do it?
I think there's scope for a prequel to Eyes of Laura Mars, you know, because I think there's the hint that she's taken up photography because she's getting these visions. And I'd sort of like to see a prequel to the film where we find out how Laura first experiences the visions and how she then develops that into art. But for the movie itself, I think they did a job of selling this in 1978 anyway. I think they did it just right. I think you could really pitch this to a modern audience, though, to an audience that knows what giallo is and an audience that accepts that big budget major studio Hollywood is capable of making stuff that is body count, that is knife murder, that is slasher-esque, but in high fashions, you know. I think you'd put the name of John Carpenter high in the advertising, and I think you'd maybe not use Faye Dunaway's name so much, because I think she's sort of been a bit forgotten now over the years.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to notice about, actually. It's interesting, just to make a final note on it. Looking at Faye Dunaway's career, it's fascinating, her career. She has a decade where she's literally the biggest star on the planet.
The queen of Hollywood, yeah.
And then she does Mummy Dearest, which I personally, I adore, but that because that is...
That's a trash tapes one, though.
100%.
This is why we can do Eyes of Laura Mars on the not so trash tapes, because Mommy Dearest is out there. Mommy Dearest exists, and Faye went there. You know, but
arguably like one of the last big roles for her that had some kind of, like, I think, praise to it, because after that she went into Mommy Dearest. She did Supergirl. And then she did loads of bit parts in other films, which kind of basically means she's kind of gone into obscurity in a weird way.
Yeah, and ended up in even doing sort of low budget movies. It's a typical Hollywood career trajectory, really, you know. Mm. I think if you were pitching Eyes of Laura Mars to a modern audience, you'd really play up the John Carpenter thing, because people who would want to see this film would love to hear that John Carpenter was involved with it.
Yes.
Tommy Lee Jones, I think, is still a big name to this day, and you could emphasize him as being part of it. And I think you'd sell this on you'd really point up the fact that it is a body count film, that it's a murder story, and that it's got this psychic angle to it. I think that's something that wasn't necessarily made more of a focus in either the advertising or in the film itself. I don't think they really make as much of the psychic angle as they could, and that's why I'd love to see a prequel to this, where we see Laura developing her ability and turning it into art and turning it into a career.
Yeah, because you mentioned in the interview at the beginning, is like suddenly about 2 years ago I was getting visions after a traumatic event.
Let's see those 2 years. I'd love to see what happened in that time, and I'd love to see, if they made it now, you know, you'd have the great possibility of casting a young actress as a sort of Faye Dunaway type. So who in Hollywood now can do that Faye Dunaway thing? And let's see Laura Mars. The junior years, you know, let's see how she develops this ability and how she turns it into art to the point where Tommy Lee Jones can actually accuse her of being a murderer.
Oh my goodness!
Which he does in this film. You could even end with that. You know, you could even end with the scene where
you could end with that recreation of the first scene where they meet,
and then the police burst in and say, "You did it," you know, and she's trying to protest her innocence.
I love that.
So yeah, I think there's real scope there to A, sell this movie to a modern audience.
Mm.
I think a modern audience would understand this, and especially a sort of a post-Giallo audience, and the people of the sort of discovered Giallo films in the past 15 years or so, of which there are a lot. I think Eyes of Laura Mars might be a film that they don't know, and I think they'd love it. Before we finish, Johan, I just want to mention a couple of things that are tangentially related to Eyes of Laura Mars. Listeners really, really need to seek this out online. Mad Magazine did a parody of it in 1979 called The Eyes of Laurid Mess.
Okay.
And it's fantastic. It's very, very faithful to the film. It was written by Larry Siegel, who was one of the regular writers on Mad, and drawn by Angelo Torres, who was one of their regular artists.
Yeah.
It's in issue 206 of Mad Magazine from 1979, but you can find all six pages online, and it's brilliant. It follows the plot of Eyes of Laura Mars very, very faithfully, except she's called Laurid Mess which is great. It sort of follows the plot, but it does it in Mad Magazine, brilliant parody style, absolutely ruthless. And the one running gag all the way through the thing is that characters keep popping in and talking about, you know, whatever's happening now on this page, you know, we're working our way up to a really great twist ending, you know.
Yeah.
So it's really, really good sort of running gag about that. So if you're a Mad Magazine fan, do check that out. The other thing, I don't know if you know this, Johan, but there's a remake of Eyes of Laura Mars.
No.
A Hong Kong Category 3 film from 1992 called Passionate Killing in the Dream.
What a title.
It's outrageous. You've got to track this down. It's got an actress called Mishika Nishiwaki as the Laura character. She's called Miss Sha-Sha, which is fantastic.
What a name.
Sha-Sha heels.
I love it.
So it's all set in Hong Kong. It's directed by Park Man Wong. It's called Passionate Killing in the Dream. And it's basically the plot of Eyes of Laura Mars. High fashion photographer takes photographs of models in disarray and a state of distress and in violent tableau. She has visions about murders. The killer seems to be getting closer and closer to her as it slashes the killer slashes their way through the swathe of people around her, the models and confidants and so on. So it's exactly the same plot of Eyes of Laura Mars, except as well as being a high fashion photographer, Miss Shah Shah is a kung fu expert.
Of course she is.
The film stops every 15 minutes for her to put her martial arts moves on everyone.
So why am I having this funny thought now? Imagine this in the Faye Dunaway version where halfway through there's just a bunch of goons come in and say, like, I'm going to get you. Sure, kung fu.
Yeah, Faye goes into a wardrobe, comes out with karate gear on and a black belt, tied very chicly around her waist, you know. And yeah, goes into praying mantis stuff.
That's hilarious. Know? I can imagine that being sort of, I imagine that being a studio's choice going, look, we need to sell this to the Americas. So America loves us for kung fu. Let's add some kung fu into this movie, which isn't supposed to have anything to do with that. It's ballsy. I'll give them that.
Yeah, and it doesn't fit at all, but that's the joy of it, you know. We've got Laura Mars or Miss Shah Shah or whatever she's called in this one. Yeah, putting all these martial arts moves on everyone. It's fabulous, and you've got to trace it and check it out. Passionate Killing in the Dream. Maybe we could do a sequel to this where we cover that on the trash tapes.
I would love that. It's like, I would love to. Once I watch it, I'm going to say, like, look, we have to talk about these random kung fu scenes in this kind of in this melodrama. Let's do that. I think that's great.
It's also got fantastic subtitles, as Hong Kong films often do, all the way through the film. People keep referring to each other as son of bitch. Son of a bitch, but son of bitch. And the very, very best subtitle on there, following an attempted same-sex seduction scene, is Miss Shah Shah announces, Catherine is a Nasbian.
A Nasbian?
N-A-S-B-I-A-N.
That's a new word I didn't even expect to hear today.
Yeah. So, yeah, Passionate Killing in the Dream. Check it out. And, Laura Mars goes kung fu.
Which I love. This is the thing. That's if Laura Mars went full-blown trash, basically. Yeah, that sounds
It is. That's the movie that we have managed to avoid talking about today. It's the film that Laura Mars could have been and managed to avoid being.
And so there's the end of our review of The Eyes of Laura Mars, a great examination of high-class trash. I would like to thank Daryl Buxton for his amazing insight and for just being the walking film library that he is. It makes my job a lot easier when my guests come so well prepared. Now, what do you think? Do you have a different vision about this film? Is it just a sleazy slasher film, or does it really have something else to say? Please feel free to write your interpretation of the film on our social media and share this episode with others. We would love to hear from you all. For those who are curious, I would recommend watching this movie twice and see if it really does provide a whole new perspective. And with that, this film essay is closed. And we will return soon with another not-so-trash review. See you all next time, cinephiles.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Thank you for listening to this podcast episode and hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it around with movie lovers you know, maybe add a star rating or write a good review. All of this helps with the algorithm and provides us with more opportunities to reach the ears to a whole new bunch of bad film fanatics. Want to find out more about us? Then head over to our socials where we provide sneak peeks and up-to-date news on everything nostalgic and trashy. You can find our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages in the description. So please, follow us. See you next time, cinephiles.